And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. There is an imminent conference on leadership in town. I mean, Geneva, any day now. And it set me thinking about leadership, good leadership, bad leadership, indifferent leadership, and what are its essentials? What are its components? And how can we make it, I mean, leadership, better? Now, I have the good fortune of having as my guest today two of the principal contributors in this conference. One is Dr. Cynthia Cherry. She's president and CEO of the International Leadership Association, an organization that I must confess I never heard of until a week or so ago, but that means nothing at all, frankly. It has some very impressive work and prominent people behind it. And my other guest is Professor Mike Hardy, who is the chairman of the International Leadership Association. He's also chair of intercultural relations and a founding director of the Center for Trust, Peace, Social Relations at the University of Coventry in central England. Both are highly regarded experts in their respective fields and were speaking via Zoom. I'm sure they'll be able to answer my questions and lead me to helping me and you, our listeners, see things a little differently in this important area. Welcome, Dr. Cherry, Sin, if I may. Welcome, Professor Hardy, Mike, if I may. Please tell me and our listeners, where are you? Sin.
Well, Michael, it's good to be here with you on Zoom with Mike, my colleague, the ILA board chair. I am in the States and I'm bi-coastal. My office is in the DC area and I am presently in California.
Well, what a wonderful lifestyle. Okay. And Mike, where are you?
It's really good to meet you. And I'm based in London, my home, but my Coventry is my university in the Midlands. But I do tend to spend as much time as I can with Sin on the East Coast whenever we get the chance, which isn't much at the moment, of course.
Yeah, of course. Well, now before we begin our conversation, please tell me a little bit about yourselves and what is this conference in Geneva that is coming up soon? Sin, you go first. Just give us a brief indication of you, your background, and what this conference is all about.
Well, Michael, for us, it is such a joy to be in Geneva this year. And as we were talking, Ambassador Christian Ducey, we were having dinner together in Brussels.
And he's been on my show. He's a great fellow. Yeah.
Yes, wonderful. And we at that point said we need to have the ILA Global Conference, which is its annual conference every year, and we have it around the world, in Geneva, because that is where there are so many of these multilateral organizations and institutions. And it's so important in this time and in this era that we bring together our leadership, educators, and experts, along with the leaders of these multilateral companies and institutions. So that is why we're in Geneva. And my background, I grew up in a large family in a rural part of the country, and education became my way to express both my leadership, but also through education, I had the opportunity to work at a number of different universities, from University of Southern California on the West Coast to the East Coast, Princeton University, and now have the real pleasure of working as the president of the ILA and working with good folk like Mike Hardy as the board chair.
Well, with an introduction like that, Mike, you can't go wrong. Well, tell us a bit about you yourself, please.
It's really hard to follow, Sin. But so I'm a simple economist that got really concerned, Michael, about the uncertainty, the unfamiliarity, the lack of common understanding that's central to human security. I started as an economist. I got involved in international relations, spent about 15 years of my career in foreign service, in diplomacy, and then returned to the university. And as you pointed out earlier, founded a center to look at these issues at Coventry University, Coventry being the UK's city of peace and reconciliation. And I am delighted that we're coming to Geneva this year, because our sister centre, the GCSP, of course, is influential and is a leading contributor. But, you know, my search in my career has been for better ways of involving leadership in generating a more secure, a better world for us all. And I looked for a leadership community that might help me learn. And I found the ILA, and it wasn't long before I joined the ILA that I became an influencer within it. And I'm privileged now to be the board chair. And, you know, leadership matters to us all, and we have to get it right. And the ILA represents a community of practitioners, of scholars, of policymakers who have one common passion, and that is to look at the challenges we face in the world today and how we can apply better leadership to move us to more positive change.
That's a good introduction, Mike. And it might be, if we have time, I know Coventry. I used to live, when I lived in England, in the neighbouring county in Staffordshire.
Right.
And it might be, if you have time and if it's appropriate, to fit in the story of the Cross of Nails and the significance of that very moving story, because it's real.
Absolutely.
And anybody who's been to Coventry or comes from Coventry knows how moving it is. Yeah. Let's just talk about leadership in a more general sense. First of all, and you're both academics, so you won't be surprised that I start the conversation with a definition or with a plea for a definition. How would you define and describe leadership? What are its recognizable qualities and components of leadership? And I've written it always with a capital L. Sin, you start.
Well, I'm going to tick off where Mike ended, and that's around today, right? Yeah. In today, the 21st century, leadership operates in this globalizing, knowledge-based, interdependent world. It's different from the 20th century, right, where we had complicated problems. But in the 21st century, we have increasingly complex systems that are amplified by these complicated problems. And so today's success in leadership is dependent upon one's connectedness. And so leadership crosses borders, right? And we have to look at the whole system in leadership today. Instead of just the individual leader, we have to look at leadership as a system and perceive it as the concerted effort of many people who work together at different places and at different levels in an organization or an assistant. So the command and control that we often think about in leadership still exists, but today, no one person knows all, right? So we have to look more at leadership as dispersed through a system, and how does a leader make meaning? It's about meaning making today. Hmm. And so if I look at a couple.
Yeah, no, go on, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I just, as I look at this, and Mike will have another lens on it, but I look at today, our global mindset or our global acuity is so important. How do we understand the other, and how do we understand other cultures is one part. And then there's another piece, as we talk about complex systems, I look at complexopacity. Mm-hmm. How do we continue
that word again, please, Sin, for the benefit of us not listening
in English
is our complex first capacity. Language. You made that up. Obviously, it's not in Webster's or Oxford, is it?
No, it's a real word. It really, truly
Seriously?
Is. But it seriously is. And it looks at how we understand complex systems.
Yeah.
Right. And how we look at an individual as connected to an organization, organizations to other organizations, to the nation, to nation states, and across the world. Right.
Okay.
Again, it goes back to our success is dependent on our connectedness.
Connectedness, and that gives meaning. Mike, can you add a supplementary to that before we go on to the next question?
So I'm pleased you started, not just because I'm an academic, but I am pleased you started with definitions. And it's really important right at this early stage to sort of underline Sin's point. We're not as interested in leaders as we are in leadership. And we spend most of our time trying to extract the impact and consequences of the focus on individual personalities, leaders, rather than looking at leadership. And that's because we're searching for a better way, a better world. And the complexity that Sin refers to means that we have to mobilize connections and interdependencies. So my definition is very simple. Leadership in this sense is the practice of mobilizing others, mobilizing people to tackle tough challenges and to thrive. So it's about a process, an engagement, a negotiation, a reconciliation. It's all those things, but it's about mobilizing our understanding to bring a better outcome.
I think that leads us very nicely into my next question, and which allows you to expand on what you said, because there's a lot in what you said, even though, as good teachers, you made it sound, you know, unbelievably simple and straightforward. I know from my own experience, and my career goes back, I started my working life in 1970. So I've, you know, been doing things a long time as well in different professions. I know from experience there are different types of leadership and leaders. I've not met many good leaders in person, but the ones that I've met made a big impact on my life. But how would you describe the different types? And where do qualities like humility and empathy fit in? Because they are words which I hear much more nowadays than when I was a young executive in the 1970s.
So this is...
Mike, you go first.
If I may, Sin, yeah. Michael, this is a really good chance to talk about Coventry and its history, because it's very direct. During the Second World War, the beautiful Renaissance Cathedral was destroyed one night in an accident of bombing. I don't think anyone thinks it was deliberate, but Coventry is a city which makes armaments and weapons and was a target. It was destroyed. What happened in the morning is amazing. And it's a very powerful example of how an inspirational individual caused a leadership process that transformed the lives of people. In the morning, the bishop in Coventry found this destroyed cathedral. He found among the relics of the burnt out wood, two nails that had been forged together, which they refer now to as the Cross of Nails. But before that, he turned to the people that were standing around him. 600 people had died that evening. He turned to the people and said, "Father, forgive." And, you know, the people in Coventry were angry. They were not in the business of forgiveness. And they said to Bishop, "We will never forgive the Germans." And he turned to them quickly and raised his finger and said, "I wasn't talking about the Germans." So in his inspiration, his foresight and vision for a better place was one in which we wouldn't be bombing each other in the first place. The city became the UK's City of Peace and Reconciliation. In the weeks after the war, busloads of men from Coventry went to Dresden to help with the rebuilding. And it's now the most twin city in the world, has more than 22 other cities. But I only use that example, A, because it's an emotional and powerful story, but it's a very powerful story of leadership, not on the reliance on anyone, on one bishop to lead into the future, but one bishop to mobilize people into a way of thinking that would lead to better things.
It's just as a supplementary to that, for young people, and when I say young, under, say, 40, and particularly they're from Germany, who might not be familiar with the story. In my recollection, Willy Brandt, when he was mayor of Berlin, went to Coventry. Am I correct?
He did indeed.
And it was a very moving ceremony. I remember that.
Yes.
And do you want to add to what Mike said before I move on in our conversation? So I've got some more questions to ask you about the leaders and leadership.
Well, Michael, just that Dresden is one of my favorite cities in Germany, and is one that I go back to and is drawn to. Because of the sense of place. And leadership is also about the sense of place.
Yeah.
Right. So people study leadership and leaders from all different angles. If it's from person to position to performance to process to place. And the story that Mike just shared embodies all of those, right? An individual who is in a position who also is looking at the results, but the process and the forgiveness and the relationship, but it's all embedded in the context.
Well, let me ask you now a question which may sound trite, and if it does, forgive me, but there's a reason I put it the way I've written it. Do we really need, the emphasis on need, good leaders? Is it merely a bonus when we have them? If we do, what constitutes good leader, good leadership from bad? I mean, history is full of both. Jesus Christ to Winston Churchill, Ho Chi Minh to George Washington, Joan of Arc to Adolf Hitler. The list is long. But you pay your money, you take your choice. Do we really need them, or can we get along fine without them?
It's a great question, and I love how you framed it. I'm going to go, and then I know Michael has some things that I think we need good leaders and good followers. Right? We need both. And they're also, you know, those leaders in those positional roles that we aspire to or look for inspiration, they have, as Ronnie Heifetz would say, they have authority that goes along with that position. Along
the benefit of us who don't know who Ronnie Heifetz, just tell us who he is.
Thank you. Ronnie Heifetz is one of the leading scholars in leadership and has written about adaptive leadership, right?
Adaptive leadership and
authoritarian leadership. And then we also need followers who have the responsibility to their community and to each other. So you need good followers and good leaders. And sometimes they switch places, right? You have a follower who becomes that and takes that leadership role.
Could you give an example?
If you look at an organization, sometimes Mike would do this in his organization, I in mine, there are times when somebody has more expertise in an area. And so they take that leadership role at that point because they have the expertise at that point. There are sometimes when followers come out of and they challenge the leader in that position and will check them, right, in that sense. So I go back to you need good leaders and good followers to move forward.
To get a familiar familiar character for your listeners, Mahatma Gandhi, superb example of someone who led a moment in his life, created an inspirational movement, but stepped back on others. He never ran a business. He never ran a government. He never ran a post office. But by goodness, he mobilized people to do that. So he was both a leader and probably the best follower we can point to.
There's my impression that we focus a little bit too much on political leaders rather than the many other professions where people are organized more or less into groups or communities and where leadership of quality is important. But let's examine some other ones. For example, in healthcare, it's topical. What have been your observations of leadership, whether poor or good, during the COVID-19 pandemic, which still continues? Who stands tall, where, and why? Mike, do you want to kick off on that one?
Sure. So, the World Health Organization came to the ILA's last conference and brought a simple message that the crisis the world was facing was not a public health crisis, was not a crisis in fighting a virus. It was a crisis of leadership in how the world got hold of this position in a collaborative sense. The public health crisis that we're currently in and hopefully soon to be leaving is a very good example of Sin's points of, adaptive challenges of complex systems. And those leaders that have done best during, in my opinion, my humble opinion, are those people who've captured the science, who stepped back and allowed the science to make the decisions rather than the political expediency. Politicians are well known. Their job is to look for the next election, the next 3 to 4 years. Scientists look for hundreds of years. And knowing when, you asked earlier about a good leader knows when they're out of their depth and when the challenge that they face must draw on different authorities than the authority given to them by a political process or a democracy. So you can see some of the best examples. Look at our wonderful woman leader in New Zealand, who was very clear, having listened to the scientists, closed her borders, imposed a regime that people were very uncomfortable with, but for the most part has been the most successful leadership of the pandemic. It's much easier, of course, if you're a tiny, isolatable country.
The story's still running, isn't it?
But look down in Latin America, look at Peru, probably the worst case scenario of all. And it's probably because nobody stepped up to evaluate who was best in the best position to take the leadership inspiration forward.
Ben, do you have a comment? Do you have a point you wanted to add to that one? I'm just keeping an eye on my clock.
Michael, I guess part of what you're bringing up is the importance of there is so much more than just political leadership, but that's what we hear so much about in the media, right? And healthcare now has been pulled up because of the pandemic. And I think one of the other things you're talking about here is crisis leadership. And there's been a lot studied around crisis leadership, but it's again about how do you put forward with what you know and what you don't know? And how do you bring the right people to the table so that you have a leaderful organization with the experts needed, in addition to the science, the other areas that are important? So I think we have to look at this. Often history continues to write itself and it rewrites itself. This pandemic, it's going to have lessons to learn from for many, many years to come.
I agree with you. I have two guests today, Dr. Cynthia Cherry, speaking via Zoom from the West Coast of the United States, and Professor Mike Hardy, also via Zoom, who is in London, and we're talking about leadership. Now, as modern societies are driven increasingly by technological advances, what do you see as you look at leadership in the field of, say, technology? Are there examples to marvel at, or indeed to question, and why? Mike, do you want to kick off on that one?
So technology is probably the greatest challenge of all, and digital technology in particular. And, you know, Sin referred earlier to the power of connection. And the power of connection, the reason for its powerfulness is because it's both good and bad. So the very things that drive us together, the interconnectedness, the easy jet of flying from here to there, but the internet of where everything is connectable, also has made us very vulnerable and highly insecure. So leadership of technology is not about innovation and experimentation and finding out how science can change things for us. It's also about the leadership of protection against vulnerability and how we manage against the cyber complexities. There's a very, very good book I'd recommend to your listeners by Mark Leonard, who's published recently a book called The Age of Unpeace. And he talks about the age of unpeace.
Yes.
And he says, you know, that the very things that connect us actually makes us more vulnerable. And my idea of powerful leadership is that which recognizes the profundity of change that will take place with technology and the challenges it will create.
And Finn, is your West Coast home in any way influenced by Silicon Valley and those neighbors that you must have?
I think we all are. As interconnected as we all are, that impacts all of us around the globe. Mike brought up a beautiful point, and the book is a worthy book to read. Another one that I think we all know is Tom Friedman's book, The World is Flat. And I love the example he used here because he was reflecting on when he wrote that book just 10 years later. And he said, when I wrote that book, Twitter was a sound, the cloud was in the sky, a 5G was a parking spot, an application was what you did to apply to college.
Exactly.
Right? None of those words, that technology existed.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. So, and Mike's point is a very important one, that as the more connected we are, the more influential we can be, but the more connected we are, the more misinformation, the more dangerous we can be as well.
Now,
those
are
leadership problems.
We cannot have a conversation about leadership without addressing the current trend towards populism, and in the extreme case, demagoguery. Are some populations, this is my question, are some populations more prone to be seduced by populist leaders? What ingredients are required to facilitate this? Sin, you start.
Well, actually, this is where, as a leader, I know where my experts are, and I totally defer to Mike on this one. This is his area.
Okay. Mike, go ahead.
So populism is a very current issue, and it's a contemporary challenge that we have. And for me, it describes very well the imperfections we have in society and the prevalence of poor leadership that is part of that. So when you think of the research that we're currently doing, both in the social sciences and more broadly in the business sciences, the qualities of the best practice leadership that we have, you don't come out with populism. Populism is the result of imperfections, and it's quite short-lived. We're fortunate, I think, in that regard. If you think of the five qualities that we know from research that lead to strong and sustaining leadership relationships, firstly, ethics. I don't see many populist leaders, either on the left or the right, that actually wake up in the morning and have ethics for breakfast at all. Secondly, you have stakeholder engagement. How many populist leaders do you know that actually value other people's views and other people's opinions?
It depends on the stakeholder, doesn't it? Yeah.
how many populist leaders do you think actually listen? And those who do listen, how many hear anything other than their own rhetoric?
Yeah.
So the qualities I'm reporting to you, of course, are the evidence of sustainable long-term leadership, and they don't point at populist leaders. So populist leaders, I hope, an aberration of the short term. They're a product of imperfections, of stress. They're the product of communication systems, quite often political systems, that exploit uncertainty and that exploit people's anxieties in the short term. So because I'm more interested in the process of leadership than the leader, I don't spend much time worrying about populist leaders. I look more at the way in which we can democratize leadership, reinforce and empower the strength of followership, which ultimately deals with the problem, I think.
Do you want to add to that, even though he's the expert? Do you have a comment to make on that?
I think what it does is it reinforces, one, the importance of distributive leadership, leadership throughout an organization, right? Throughout a nation, throughout a country. And the importance of how we all, as followers and leaders, have a responsibility to the greater good, to the greater whole.
It brings beautifully to our last question, because your conference is taking place in Switzerland. I've lived here nearly 40 years in the German-speaking part and the French-speaking part. So I have a sense of, I think I understand the culture. We should look at the local culture as it relates to leadership. This is a society, if you're not aware of this already, where decisions, political and others, are driven from the bottom up and not from the top down. It's a confederation, not a federation. It's a very important distinction. Consensus is critically important, though slow. What do your experiences of leadership tell you about how it works in societies that demand a high level of community and eschew the big man or big woman way of decision-making? Sin, why don't you start on that one?
I'm going to start with saying leadership is hard work. And at the same things, collaborative leadership, cooperative leadership is so integral and important to our present and future society. Going back to what Dr. Tedros said with the from the WHO, the United Nations is saying the same thing. In today's fractured society, what we need to do is to figure out new and different ways to lead through our fractured society, to find ways to work collectively together and still be competitive with each other. That's hard work. That's why we are in Geneva, because we can also learn from each other. Mike and I are heading up a global leadership roundtable with senior thought leaders and leadership scholars talking about this very topic around global leadership for the future.
Mike, hard work as it is, could you try and focus on where people's energy is best expended? That's important, I think.
So the Swiss example is a good one. And it's absolutely right, Michael, of you to raise it as a case study. Civil society and civic conversations are the necessary ingredients of progress. Just as other things you could say, science and the freedom to the liberation of innovation and enterprise. But civic conversations are really important. Look what happened with a bottom-up movement in the south of Ireland, in Southern Ireland recently, when there were changes in the laws on that protected women and abortion rights in a society that for many years had struggled with modernity. What happened was that civic conversations took place. And politicians weren't sitting up here not listening. They had to listen because these powers for mobilizers. So there's three or four things that the Swiss experience shows us. It's not perfect. If we had another half hour, we could go through some of the issues, some of the inequalities, some of the differences that exist. But the Swiss model is defined by an ability to ask questions rather than defined by predetermined solutions. It's defined by an ability to continuously learn. You know, the World Economic Forum is in Geneva. It's no mistake why it's there also. It's there because it's a vibrant city in which learning and sharing takes place.
And an international city where half the population is foreign. More than half the population is, yeah.
And it benefits from that. And finally, there's a notion of multi-generation as well in Switzerland. You see then a mobilization where the young aren't put to one side and the old put to another. There is much more of multi-generational activity. It's really interesting, and good role model and good play. But essentially, bottom up is the way you sustain top-down effectiveness, because bottom up is the way in which communities hold their leaders to account.
Thank you, Sin and Mike. Thank you so much for answering my questions so succinctly and lucidly, because it's not an easy topic to encapsulate like that. I hope your conference in Geneva goes well. I think it starts next Tuesday or Wednesday.
October 20th.
Soon. Yeah, sometime soon. I wish you well, and I wish we did have more time, but we're out of time. My guests today have been Dr. Cynthia Cherry and Professor Mike Hardy, and we've been talking about leadership. Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.